You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. Big shout out to everyone who came out to Snacky Tunes Salon, our first live event in a few years, hosted at Chow Now here in LA. We're going to have a few more events in the near future, so please stay tuned. And thank you to everyone who signed up for the newsletter. More issues to come out in the next few weeks. We sit down with our friend Niels Bernstein, whose new book, The Joy of Oysters, is now out on Artisan. It is a fantastic read full of oyster pop culture, recipes, their environmental impact, and he shares his favorite tunes when he's shucking and hosting an oyster party. Then we dive deep into the archives for Finnish songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Pepina. She shares a live and studio performance with us, including her song, Moments. It's a really great chat and a really good time. One note. In our conversation about oysters, I say Astral Works instead of Astral Weeks. I apologize, Mr. Morrison. We love the album, no less. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
It's not that easy to be one of us. But speaking up seems so dangerous. You shut it down, you shut the mouth. Keep your body fighting through the mess that's in your head. All in your head. Breathe. Fire the gun.
Mills, congratulations. Thank you for joining us on Snacky Tunes. We were actually talking the day after the book came out. How does it feel? The book is out. I'm holding it. You're touching it. We work so much in this digital landscape, but I'm flipping through the pages, and it's such a beauty to behold.
It's really beautiful. I mean, I'm really thankful to Artisan that they made it beautiful without any input for me in that regard. but, you know, having worked in music so long where there's also Tuesday release dates, it really feels like I finally am getting my own record release, you know?
No, it's great. Especially now since so many albums don't even get a physical release.
Right.
This is something you can really tote around town. You can like leave this on the table and be like, what am I reading? This is my book.
And I will say that, like, you know, I saw the layouts for so long, so I thought it was kind of anticlimactic when I actually received it in hand, but not at all. I mean, I'm still really giddy when I can actually browse through it and hold it.
Yeah, there's something about like flipping through instead of scrolling through that really brings it to life.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
So, I mean, listen, I've been a fan of oysters, I think, maybe since I've been belling up to the bar at Maison Premiere for a decade plus, and they've always been in my life. But I feel like they really made their way back into the mainstream over the last few years. Even those who may have found it squeamish have now found it this accoutrement to a sunset, sipping champagne and having a dozen oysters or something like that.
Yeah.
What do you think's attributed to that return? And what made oysters go out of fashion in the first place?
It's a really good question. I think a lot of it is the proliferation of oyster farming and the improvement in oyster farming. So it's quite easy to get really good quality oysters where it used to be a little bit more of a crapshoot. So you can go to a neighborhood place, even in a city, and get really good quality oysters that have been recently harvested, stored really well.
Sure.
And that wasn't always the case. It wasn't dangerous to order them before, but it was dangerous in the sense that you didn't really know what the quality was going to be, both in size and taste, the way that they were. There's maybe a bit more, you know, the food revolution or whatever you want to call it.
There's of course.
More pride in making sure that the product's really great, but also in how it's presented. You know, I rarely get bits of shell in my oysters anymore at restaurants. No. And I used to all the time.
Yeah, I used to be picking those out after a slurp. And it did not, especially for those who didn't see it as something easy or something that was a little bit maybe unknown. Because it could be intimidating at times to say oysters. But a lot of places would just say, we have oysters. Do you want a dozen? And people go, great. And they don't even ask.
Yeah.
They don't even ask.
Which is good and bad, I think. You know, I think you mentioned Maison Premier. You can go there and it's very trustworthy. You don't have to think twice. Of course you're going to order oysters there. They really, you know, pay a lot of attention and care about what they do. But, you know, oysters, depending on, you know, where they get them or whatever, can be lucrative for a restaurant. So many places have them, but that doesn't mean that they're storing them well, serving them well, sourcing them well. So it is important that just because they're so easy to find, it's still important to really, you know, get to know the place. Maybe order a few before you order two dozen.
Yeah.
Sure that you're getting a really good oyster.
I mean, look, I was just back in the suburbs of Philadelphia and we were at this nice sushi place and they listed two oysters. One was East Coast oyster and one was West Coast oyster. There was no specification of what it was. But you go like, all right, it's a sushi spot. I'll trust that the quality is there.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think, you know, there might be a place that gets, you know, jars of shucked oysters because they have fried oysters or something on their menu.
Which is totally fine.
But then there's, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But then they're like, oh, darn, you know, people want an oyster hand roll. They want an oyster. Okay. Let's just, you know, try to make it happen with what we have. And you're looking at, you know, doesn't always work out perfectly.
No. Now, writing a book on oysters makes me think that you have your own personal story and relationship with oysters. And, you know, Bourdain famously had that eating the oyster in France as a young kid that you could say that story is responsible for probably a lot of stories about oysters in the world. Do you have your own, was there a turning point in your career where you're like, I'm going to dedicate a whole book in a few years to this one subject?
I mean, in terms of my kind of revelatory experience with oysters, I don't remember anything, you know, and like
they were just always there.
Specific events, you know, not just about oysters. I just don't remember anything. I grew up in Seattle where they were quite prevalent. And we didn't have a lot of money and we were really into food. So we were interested in things that we could obtain for free. The beautiful yellow Italian plum trees around town.
Sure.
The great Himalayan blackberries that grow on the side of the road in Seattle. And it meant going a little bit out of town and digging for clams and grabbing oysters. So it was really I think I had a taste for seafood from a really, really young age.
Sure. The salinity in your veins.
I think so. Even, you know, really stronger fish I always really liked as a kid. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, oh my God, what a, you know, bizarre thing that I either was blown away by or had to take a liking to. I just kind of liked it. I lumped it in with squid and scallops and clam and everything else that we were eating. But, you know, the initial appeal was that it was just incredible to me that they, you know, they took years to come to maturity and you could just pluck them off rocks in low tide. It just seemed like magic.
Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit of magic, and that magic is sort of peeked into in the book because you get into the growing cycle and how it all comes to be from seed, because it is a seed, to plate in many ways. And I think what really surprised me about the book was that it is an almanac in some ways. It really is this, it's got pop culture, it's got recipes, it's got stories, it's got myth busting and things like that, but it's all focused around the oyster, which, you know, in pitching a book, sometimes when you go out and say, hey, I have this singular subject, you're hanging your hat on it. And it's great because you took it in a lot of different tangents, but still you got to like an oyster to like this book, at least from like, I'm going to buy this and publish this. How was that process in the pitching?
I think for me, I really like single subject books. You know, I think they're a fun way to just play around and go deep but also going broad. You know, there's just like, okay, if I'm going to do oysters, let's do everything about oysters. And I noticed that a lot of the oyster books on the market, they're really good. But they can be kind of micro. There's the Kurlansky book, The Big Oyster, about the oyster influence in New York, which is an unbelievable book, like all of his. But it's, you know, it's very specific. It's this, you know, it's a historical tale of the importance of oysters in history. And there's a lot that go really deep into specific farms. There's ones that are just recipe based. I just kind of wanted to do one that was more playful and that whatever your level of oyster interest or oyster knowledge, you could just kind of open to the middle and find something interesting or fun or inspiring or whatever. So I think, I can't speak for the publisher, but I think it was kind of that spirit of, it's kind of a coffee table book. It's kind of a cookbook.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're going to buy one book on oysters or bring it to a party or something, it's a very, it's not out of reach of somebody. Anybody that has the faintest interest in oysters will find a lot to like, I guess.
I think one of the things I liked so much was how much pop culture and other parts of history that you brought into it, where the oyster was the inspiration for something. And even in opening up the book, you have this Eleanor Clark quote, if you don't love life, you can't enjoy an oyster. Yeah. And there's other quotes. It made me realize, you know, Shakespeare, Tom Robbins, Oscar Wilde. Yeah. I was like, oh, wow, oysters are really throughout history. But why start the book with that quote? And how much do you believe the fact that if you don't like an oyster, because again, like it is very subjective, you're like, it, you can't enjoy life.
Yeah. Well, you know, oysters are alive.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you eat them, there's something very sensual about them, whether it's the way they look, the way they feel, the way they taste, the situation you're in when you're eating them. And there's, you know, they, as much as people like to talk about that they used to be a food for the poor when they were very, you know, prevalent in the 1800s,
right,
they've
right.
always been a food for the rich as well. They've always had this connotation of luxury. So I think it's this kind of like, when you like oysters, you're appreciating the sensuality, the life, the power, the strength in the flavor. You're not looking for something tasteless. And I don't know, it's like a food you can connect with in a way that you don't connect with a parrot, maybe. So I would tend to agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have, I believe it's in the book, and it's this, there's famous or similar famous photos of the oyster cart in Lower East Side and turn of the century. And while I've been lucky enough to sit in some very gilded rooms, sipping martinis, eating oysters, obviously this doesn't exist anymore, but God, would I love to be getting off the subway and seeing an oyster cart guy and go, you know what? I'll do half a dozen on the way home.
Yeah. You know, the Chinese takeout container.
I had no idea. I had no idea.
And it's just because it was folded paper and it was a way to, like you say, when you were just like, ooh, give me a scoop of oysters out of that barrel. It was a very cheap, convenient way to bring them home.
Yeah. I feel like with the hot summer days in New York, a hot scoop of oysters on the cart, maybe the health department isn't passing it these days, but man, that would be nice. That would be nice to pick up.
Yeah, and they're reasonably resilient. You know, you can don't want to, you know, stop off for too long of a round of drinks on the way home with your scoop of oysters on a hot day. But you know, you can make your way home with them. I think, you know, from what I could glean, to really oversimplify it, is that there was a whole lot of oysters, and the rich people got the best oysters,
sure,
and the other people got fine oysters.
Fine oysters. But hey, we've all had fine oysters and they're still pretty good oysters.
It's like pizza.
We're going to have a quick musical break and then we come back. I want to talk a little bit about the recipes and a little bit of the music that you like to play while shucking oysters and hosting a party.
Okay, perfect.
We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Everybody's telling me to watch out. Even I could see there will be fallout. Cause it fell in my mind up and down. If you want out, then say something. No, don't you leave me in the dark now. Just say something. Keep waiting and I'm gonna. But it's telling me to watch out. Don't you leave me in the dark.
Snacky Tunes. We are chatting with Nils Bernstein, author of The Joy of Oysters, out on Artisan this week. And we were talking about the prevalence of oysters in America and around the world at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people don't understand is the environmental impact this had on purifying the water. Mm-hmm. And you look at things now like the Billion Oyster Shell Project, which is trying to reseed different coastal areas in America and around the world. And while it's a known fact about how they purify water and things like that, it actually is pretty prevalent in your book to talk about how these really fit into the ecosystem. Why include that point of view in your book?
I think the you know, it's topical, I guess, you know, talking about the environmental impact on our foodways. But with oysters, it's like, you know, there's virtually no wild oysters left that are commercially available. You know, there might be some places where they have, you're allowed to harvest within limits if you're lucky enough to find one. But basically 99% of wild oyster stocks have been decimated. So not only is, you know, there's a lot of negative information and false information out there about aqua farming, but whatever you think about fish and shellfish farming, oyster farming is a net positive, however you look at it. So it's really, for me, it was to, you know, reiterate that point that oysters from an oyster farm are not, they're most likely going to be much better quality than if you were to find a wild oyster. And they're doing incredible work because oysters are, you know, we need billions and billions and billions more of them. So more oyster farms, the better, within reason, based on land leases and whatnot.
Sure.
But, you know, all of that's pretty tightly controlled. So, you know, I think it's, you know, oyster farmers are doing really, really, really important work. And they also happen to be making incredible oysters of really reliable quality. So I think that that environmental aspect of it is really to help promote the idea that farmed oysters are not only good, they're important. You know, it's almost a, it's like a moral imperative to eat oysters.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that every time I'm sucking back a dozen, I'm doing
God's work.
Doing God's work in the green space.
That's right.
One of the things that I also picked up in the book, and you know, you talk about wild versus farmed, is how international oysters really are. Mm-hmm. And the majority of my oyster eating can be really, say, I had it in America and I've had it in France.
Yeah.
But you go all over the world. And I wanted to ask, how many places did you get to visit and how many oysters do you think you put back during this research time? But also, where was the most interesting and unique and exciting place you found oysters?
I think, you know, my oyster interest is a lifelong thing. So over the years, I've, you know, been lucky enough to have oysters and visit oyster farms in a lot of places. But I would say a few places where I was not really, well, maybe a little surprised to see how deeply oysters were connected to the food and the culture was in Ireland.
Wow. Yeah. Not in my mind at all.
Huge oyster. And in fact, French people hate this, but a good amount of the oysters in France are Irish oysters that are finished in France.
Mm.
But they originate, you know, they start their life in Ireland.
And they get shipped to the salty waters.
Yeah, they spend the last 6 months of their life to get that, you know, get that
tumbling
color.
But
Ireland, the west coast of Ireland, is an incredibly good place to grow oysters. And it's funny, in Ireland, when you talk about that, people don't think of Ireland as a oyster eating place. They can't believe it. You know, to them, it's the most obvious thing in the world that they're an important oyster country. And it really is. They have a million oyster festivals. You see them everywhere. It's a great, great country for oysters. And also Australia and New Zealand really good for oysters and have these distinctive oysters, the Sydney rock oyster and the New Zealand rock oyster, that are really delicious and a different species than what we get in the U.S.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have some of those at Depot in Auckland, which is this great oyster restaurant down there. And speaking of different places all over the world, getting into the recipes, that was really fun as well, because it wasn't just, and don't get me wrong, I love oysters Rockefeller and was recently able to enjoy a few of those with Balthazar, but seeing some Korean oyster fritters, some Filipino oyster quinoa, some Mexican oyster cocktails. I didn't expect you to have this international recipe point of view, but it really is all tied together through this one ingredient.
Oh, I think so. I mean, Korea is a major both consumer and supplier of oysters. And they're, again, it's another thing that maybe people don't associate with Korean cuisine, but I imagine that Korean people would be quite surprised that people don't associate oysters with Korea, because they're very, very popular, and it's a really important country for exporting oysters as well. And China, of course, is the leading producer of oysters, and really all over. Well, I mean, you know, all over the world, really, anywhere there's suitable, you know, cool
conditions,
brackish water, you know, someone is growing oysters. And yeah, I don't know. I'd say, you know, part of it is things that my developing recipes based on things that I had eaten.
Mm.
Some of them were just kind of invented out of my own, what I thought, you know, trial and error with what I thought would work.
Did you come across oyster mayo, or did you create oyster mayo?
I heard about it.
Can you explain what it is?
So oysters can be used in place of eggs to emulsify homemade mayonnaise.
Wild.
It's wild. And in fact, I found that also the case with regular mayo. If you do it like in a Vitamix or something that's too fast, it can break it.
Yeah.
So doing it by hand is kind of a hassle, but you want to do it in a food processor or a regular blender on low speed.
Yeah.
But you know, I tested it and I had to work out the ratios for ideal flavor. But the first time I made it, it just worked. It came together and it was like my heart was racing. I couldn't believe how perfectly it worked. And then you tweak the flavor a little bit and you really have a beautifully rich, you know, they give you a similar richness to what eggs do. And of course it's oil. So, but then you get this oyster flavor that you can perk up with a little lemon juice and a little bit of the oyster liquor. And it's really, it's pretty amazing. I did it, with some friends in Maine. There was a great oyster farm on North Haven Island in Maine, and Chuck made some fried oysters dipped in oyster mayonnaise. And just
there we go. Amazing. There we go. It's like the snake eating its own tail.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's been deep fried and emulsified.
Exactly.
You know, reading this book and hearing the recipes and the oyster mayo, and summer's upon us, and you dispel and get it, you know, put to rest that our myth of not eating oysters during those months. It only made me think of throwing like parties and having dozens and dozens of oysters on the table.
Yeah.
What do you have planned for your summer and for parties, and set the scene a little? What's on the soundtrack? How are you going to host people who are probably not going to come to you and expect at all times that you're shucking?
Right. Well, you know, if you're cooking oysters or pickling oysters or something, you can shuck ahead of time, and they even freeze quite well.
I read that. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, you know, you can even get them frozen in shell, and it works more or less. But you know, if you're frying, you're stewing, I like pickling oysters to put out at a party on like a creative kind of pickle plate. And so I'll often have for a party, I'll try to have some like oyster dishes that I can do ahead, maybe some oyster shooters. And then just have a ton of oysters out of live oysters with a ton of knives and a ton of dish towels. And there's always people that want to give it a shot. There's either people that are really proud of how well they shuck oysters, people that believe they'll be really good at it, or people that just want to give it a shot. So if you have a group of people shucking oysters with glasses of wine, it's super fun. It's fun to do. It's fun for people to watch. And you end up with a lot more oysters than you would if I was just doing it myself all afternoon.
Yeah. I mean, I remember learning one hazy night at a Death & Co. supper club in Brooklyn. And once you learn it, it's one of the best skills to have of how to pop a shell.
Yeah. It's a good feeling. And they go pretty fast. Like once you have the oyster, anything you're doing with it is coming, whether you're eating it raw or cooking with it, it's coming together pretty fast. So, you know, if it's taking you a minute to get it open, no big deal, because you're going to be eating it soon enough. And with multiple people shucking, it works really well. And also with oyster knives, I find that different people prefer different oyster knives for whatever reason, the way their hands are shaped or the way they like to get in the shell. So, you know, if you put out an assortment of oyster knives, it's not like one guy has the good knife and everybody else waiting for it. Generally, you know, different people like different knives, and it works out. But you asked about soundtrack
too. Yeah, because I feel like you probably have one soundtrack for shucking and prepping, and then one soundtrack for the party. And knowing how deep your love of music goes, I'm sure they're tuned in quite perfectly.
It's funny you say that, because I do have different. I mean, not like I know ahead of time what the soundtrack is going to be, but for me, oysters, it's kind of like a nostalgic thing, and there's a comfort nostalgia thing to just kind of shucking oysters and playing with oysters alone. And so I tend to put on things that are more nostalgic. I also tend to maybe be drinking wine while I'm shucking oysters, because, you know, you're standing for a while. And generally when I'm drinking, the music gets a little more nostalgic as well. So it might go back to 70s. I mean, I don't know, like trying to think what I just recently shucked like 60 oysters in one session. And I don't know, I was playing Cat Stevens.
I was going to say little like Van Morn Afterworks.
Totally. I could
shucking oysters, sipping wine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely put on you said Astralworks. That's good. Fleetwood Mac.
Sure.
Might come on there.
The chain to match what's on your hand so you don't pierce it, right?
Right. And, you know, Fairport Convention and Richard Thompson. I've been known to put some of that on. God, what else? Sometimes maybe some like, you know, kind of 80s. Kind of sad power indie, like My Bloody Valentine, Dinosaur Jr.
Oh yeah. I always like a little like Dave Brubeck as well when I'm in the, you know, just to pre-party, maybe like post oyster shucking, pre-party into the start of the party.
Yeah, I was going to say that gets
cocktail hour.
That starts to get into cocktail hour.
Yeah.
Sure. I like having, when I'm shucking and just cooking in general, I like having songs with a real, like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes long, because I kind of keep track of time that way. But then as people start to show up, and again, it's oysters, you want to keep it lively, right? You want to keep it fun. You don't want people get so stressed out and intimidated about oysters, both shucking, preparing, even eating them, that you want to keep it kind of fun and easy. So, you know, like Brazilian pop, or Brazilian, like Os Mutantes or something a little weirder to keep people on their toes a little bit. 80s new wave.
Sure.
It's tricky, you know, you don't want to go too cornball, but you know, some well thought out kind of early 80s synth.
Once you see a dozen wine bottles stacked up by the door, then all bets are off and you can sort of just start letting the lyrics fly.
Well, you definitely, it's fun to like look back on your, you know, Spotify or to look back at what you played at the end of a party versus yeah. the beginning of it and just see how I don't know.
You're like, oh, Jay took over here. I get it.
Exactly.
A lot of Dell and B-sides.
Yeah, it gets a little more drunken, a little more emo.
Yeah.
Somebody puts on the dead, then someone has to.
Someone's got to take the dead off, and then yeah. Strel's like, no, the dead stays on.
The dead stays on.
So, listen, one of the best parts of the book, and it was towards the end, the one that actually made me laugh out loud was the 10 random paintings featuring oysters in it. And as a lover of food, and look, the Norton Simon Museum over in Pasadena is doing a whole retrospective on classics that feature food. It was fun to see oysters pop up in these different paintings.
Yeah.
Outside of having the same food theme, what sort of tied these artworks together?
I mean, I think, you know, oysters are a metaphor for a lot of things. The pearl, you know, generally pearls and general connections with sex and sensuality seem to be a common thread. So, you know, you see them a lot in still lives, and I think they often represent feminine presence or feminine energy. And they also tend to show up in these feast photos of people just, you know, general decadence where there's oyster shells on the floor and there's people, you know, jugs of wine and people falling over and, you know, these kind of feast scenes. Oysters tend to show up a lot because, again, they were a lot more prevalent and more inexpensive back then. So they would have feasts where people are downing dozens upon dozens of oysters each. So there's some, I think there's some level of metaphor, and there's also some aspect of literalness that they just were a food that showed up at feasts.
Yeah.
That were being depicted in art.
You're rich enough to have your portrait painted, you're probably having some feasts featuring oysters.
No question.
Back in that time.
It was funny. I went to the Met recently and it was amazing how many different rooms and eras and exhibitions had worked into the artwork somehow.
Yeah. Look, like I said, I felt the same way when I was reading the quotes. I was like, wow, oysters have really been with us all these years. Listen, congratulations. Joy of Oysters out now in Artisan. If people want to order the book, where can they go? And if they want to follow along on your adventures, where can they go?
Well, I guess Instagram is best for me. It's just my name, Niels Bernstein. The book is available everywhere. I don't know how better to...
My favorite bookstore, everywhere.
I like the idea of people buying it at physical bookstores. It's a physical book. You buy it at a physical bookstore. I'm really looking forward to traveling around the U.S. and actually holding it in my hand and taking selfies with the book in bookstores.
Yes. Do you have any plans for a book tour coming up?
I do. Yeah. It's I'm going to do May 17th in Seattle. It's the first event with Hama Hama Oysters and the chef Renee Erickson at Book Lager.
I mean, could you get a better oyster chef to partner with?
Incredible. No, it's going to be. In June, we're doing, San Francisco, L.A., Santa Barbara, East Coast, Boston or Duxbury with Island Creek.
Sure.
New York eventually, haven't planned it yet. I think Newport, maybe Mystic, DC, Maine. So yeah, still in the process of working everything out, but some really, really, really fun stuff planned.
Amazing. Well, I cannot thank you enough. Congratulations on this.
Thank you so much. I'm such a Snacky Tunes freak. So I'm really appreciative.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it's an absolute joy to have you on, and it was an absolute blast to read, and it's been a while since I've outright laughed in the best way possible.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
And we have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio.
Pepina.
Hey.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Happy release week.
Yeah, thank you. It's very exciting.
We're going to get to that in a second. But first, you grew up in Helsinki.
Yes, Helsinki, Finland.
Trained as a classical
flutist. Yes.
How long were you able to sustain that before you told your parents, I gotta change the instrument?
They kind of knew. I started playing the flute when I was 7, but then I got my first piano when I was 10. And they really saw the difference of me playing contemporary music and me playing classical music. It was really, I was just playing to please my teacher when I played the flute. And when I played the piano, it was just for myself.
Very alive.
Yeah.
Were you a good student, though?
I was a very good student, and my teacher was a very good teacher in a way that every time if I would learn something, we would just right away move into a new thing. Like, I always felt like, I never felt like I was a good flutist because we never stayed where I was comfortable. But that also meant that I learned really quickly and I got really good, but it also kind of took a lot of the joy away from it, so...
You couldn't just have a good week. You couldn't be like, oh, I crushed
exactly,
this.
Yeah.
I'm just going to play this for a week and then come in and like, nope, on to the next thing.
It was
You're
right
an absolute
away.
Failure all the time at everything.
That's how I felt for like 10 years. And then on the very last year when I was more into like making music and I was kind of realizing that, hey, like maybe I could use flute in my music. And it was the first time that I looked at it differently. And I kind of realized that, wow, like, I'm a decent player, but I realized it too late, and I'm still not playing flute at my shows. One day I will, though.
Really? It hasn't made it back?
It hasn't made it back. I still hear my teacher's voice in the back of my head, like, there's only one way to play it, and it's the right or the wrong way, you know, like, and if it's anything in between, it's wrong.
Is that true about the flute, that there's only one way to play it?
No, it's not. There's no one way to play any instrument, but it's just the world of classical music. You have to learn how to recreate something that's already done. So in that way, yeah, there is only one way to recreate something. But yeah, I'm definitely going to bring it back.
One day.
Yeah, one
like
day.
Like 2 EPs from now,
yes.
It's going to be all flute.
All flute.
All flute. And you heard it here first. That's
yes.
A promise.
It's a promise.
You moved over to the piano. When did you start writing songs for yourself?
Around that time. So, well, actually, there is proof that I was writing songs before that. My mom actually has this little tiny piece of paper from when I was 6 years old, and I wrote down, like, a melody. And I was like, Mom, I wrote a song. And she still has that little piece of paper. So it's been just always a part of what I do is creating melodies. But when I got my piano at the age of 10, it was suddenly not just melodies. It was harmonies. It was, like, this whole world that you could just create. And I would just... I wouldn't really learn how to play songs. I was just listening to what I was playing and basically just started writing instrumental music right away.
When did you feel that you wrote your first good song?
Oh, I don't know about that. Good is such a relative term because I actually do remember one of the first songs that I wrote. I think I was 11 or something, and it was just a really simple piano piece. And I still revisit it. I think that was a good song.
First one out the gate.
Well, it wasn't the first one, but it was definitely, like, one of the first. And I think it's all relative. Like, if I would write that today, I would think that, oh, like, it's boring, it's not complex enough, oh, it doesn't have these and this and that. But because I was 11 when I wrote it, like, that was really good for an 11-year-old.
When did you start to develop the style that you consider what you're playing now? How many years did that take?
Oh, well, I'm still in development 100%. I hope that I'm gonna keep on developing my style till the end. I would never want to find this is what I'm gonna do now. But this specific thing, I would say that it started when I first came to New York 3 years ago, and I made my first EP. And that was the first time I was really introduced to how the music industry really works, like outside of your bedroom and how, you know, music...
Outside of Helsinki.
Exactly. And how, like, music is actually produced and what goes into it and, you know, how pop music is written. Like, of course, there's no one way to write something, but I just learned a lot. And I think, you know, ever since then, I've been just learning. And I'm really excited about this new release because it definitely is a step to the right direction. I just want to keep going to that direction.
Can we hear a song?
Yes, you can.
What are you going to play for us first?
We're going to play a song from the EP. It's called Against the Grain.
A girl next door back then, she didn't know how to fit in, and everyone kept telling her, don't talk back, don't ask us why, just sit down quietly and smile. Better to be seen than heard. Is that what it means to be a good girl? Everyone, everywhere loves to feel adrenaline. Let no one get in your way. You can be the hero, the heroine. Never back down, don't refrain. It will get hard, but don't walk away. Do what you have to do just to stay and make it your kind of day. Surrender to the stories in your mind.
You've been dubbed the Queen of Sundance.
Yes.
How does one apparently get that title?
I don't know how official that title is, but
I see you brought your crown.
Yes. No, I've performed there 4 times now. I think that might add to it, just the quantity of performances. It really, Sundance has played a big role in my whole career as a musician.
How did you get involved with them it's not always so well known for music. I know there are showcases for licensing and for that, but obviously it's known for film. How did you end up there 4 years ago? What is the setting for your performances, and how has it really influenced your career?
Yeah, so actually the first time I performed there, it was because my whole career started out of uploading music online to this platform called Hit Record. And they started a TV show called Hit Record on TV that was premiering at Sundance that year. And I had been basically just uploading music online from my bedroom, not really thinking too much of it. And yeah, the site was founded by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And then he just calls me up and says that, hey, we want you to come to perform.
Classic. Yeah, JGL just, phone call.
Exactly. Yeah. It just happens. That's the way to do it. Like, that's my tip to everybody. Just get that phone call. No, but...
And then you're fine.
And then you're fine.
Yeah, then you're fine. Yeah.
Then it's done.
Did you get the call? Get the call. Then you're fine.
Exactly. But yeah, he called me up and I flew to Sundance to perform at the premiere party because it was premiering there. And that's really what... I was there just for 2 nights. It was a crazy trip. I performed just one song on a piano, and my now manager and lawyer, Stephen Beer, happened to be in the audience and just gave me his card and said that, hey, like, I like what you're doing. Let's see if we can collaborate. And then we just started talking over email and we Skyped, and he said that, you know, if you want, I can help you, you know, network in New York. I can help you, you know, set you up with a team, and we can make your first EP here if that's what you want. So that was really just the first step that brought me to US, New York specifically. And then the year after that, Steven is also hosting a New York lounge at the Sundance Film Festival. So I came there and I was performing just 5 nights in a row at his event. And this one person, Mori Lvovits, happened to be in the audience, who later on became my sponsor, who later on became the founder and owner of my now label, Honey Rose Records. And then the year after that, I was there again. And this time, that was the craziest one. I was the first person ever to open for the new music venue, Basecamp. I was performing at multiple venues there and parties. And yeah, with Sundance, because it all happens in such a small space, it's like you just never know who you're going to meet there. Mm. It's really friendly and really great. And I've always just met the really key people to my career there.
The interesting thing about Honey Rose Records, which is your label, is that it is from Park City, and it is all about getting artists who play Park City or Sundance and getting them on a record label, which is such a unique response to all the musicians that come to town during that time.
Well, that's the thing. Like Sundance and Park City, it's just... It has a very specific vibe. It's just so welcoming. And you really don't know, like, whoever could be walking, you know, on the street, whoever could come to your show. And it's like the audiences are not big in numbers, but they're, like, big in who is there.
Yes. It's quality, not quantity.
Yes.
Can we hear another song?
Yes, for sure.
What are you going to play for us?
This one is called What Does It Take, also from the EP. What does it take for us to see we're way across the line? What does it take to make it clear we don't know how to turn back time? What can I say? You keep on feeding me the same old lies. What does it take for you to stop pretending that your hands are tied? You say that we are done, that it's already gone, but I need to know if I'm the only one. Cause I'm not
New EP out this yes. past Friday. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What was the process into this record? It's very evolved sound. It's yes. a lot of growth from the last one. What changed from the previous EPs upon making this one?
So one big thing that changed that was that I actually knew what I was getting into. Because I had never, because I had never produced or like been a part of producing anything before. When I was making my first EP, I had just written songs in my bedroom and then recorded them like guitar vocals. So I didn't really know what it meant to build a production. But getting into this one, I was really heavily involved. Like every, and we really layered it out. Like I was working with the producer, Charles Newman, and we really laid it out like one layer by layer, like went through like the melodies and the, you know, sounds together, and I really was able to leave my mark to it like all the way through. Another thing was that this time I was maybe less trying to please everyone. Like, you know, with the first record, by the way, I'm really proud of that record and I love it, but with the lyrics of it, I was kind of like softer on the edges. Like I had messages, but I was trying to put them through in a way that everybody would approve and everybody would be happy with. And I'm still not like doing anything too revolutionary. Like I'm not upsetting anybody, but I really had strong visions of what I want to tell people, and I wasn't thinking too much of like the way of saying it. So it was all much clearer in my head.
What's one of the messages that you really feel came across in this EP?
I think it's one of the big ones. It's like just dare to be strong and dare to be powerful and like find that strength in you. And being strong and being powerful doesn't mean that you have to like shout it out or like be just a jerk about it. Like being strong is also being able to show that you're weak and just kind of like the different sides of being strong. And it's just so important to me, especially knowing that my audience is probably more on the younger side, probably more, you know, speaks to a lot of women. And I just always think, like, what would I want to tell myself when I was 13? Or what would I want to tell my 10-year-old cousin? Like, what are the things that I really want them to know? And one thing is that you can be strong and you can be loud and you can do whatever you want.
Also, give up the flute, take up the piano.
Yes. No, the flute was really good. And you're going to be really, really happy one day that you did take those 11 years of learning it.
One of the coolest songs or inspirations, Against the Grain, is about female comic book writers.
Yes.
Which is really awesome.
No, I saw this amazing documentary called She Makes Comics. And I kind of knew that they were looking for, you know, ending title song. And I was just so inspired. It was just this, I love comics. I love that whole world. Like I'm,
what do you read?
I know all these names in Finnish, so
that's fine. Call it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like Lassi and Levi, which is like the little boy and the tiger toy. I don't know. And
oh, Calvin and Hobbes.
Yes, Calvin and Hobbes.
Okay, I can translate for you.
Yes. yeah, I really loved comics, and I did, like, growing up in my family, I never felt that it was like was not a girl thing to do, but I did feel really awkward entering a comic store or, you know, just like talking about it to anyone other than my brother, because it did feel like I don't know about it enough that it's okay to like it. Mm-hmm.
And you also, do you draw as well?
I do, yeah.
And what type of drawings do you do and how does that tie into it?
Oh, well, it 100% ties into it. I actually like drawing has always been one of my big passions. I also read manga a lot as a teenager, as a lot of us do. And I drew that for a while. And then I just kind of turned more into the exactly like Calvin and Hobbes type of like comic strip type of drawing where you can just kind of like exaggerate certain parts of the body to like express the emotion that you want. I really love that kind of really simplistic drawing. Yeah, I love that.
Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song. Where can people find the EP, find out where you're playing? Do you have any upcoming... I know you had the release party this past weekend, but any future coming upcoming shows?
We don't have any dates confirmed yet, but you should definitely go to my website, pepinamusic.com, to find out any future dates. And the EP Spark is available on iTunes and Spotify and Google Play and Amazon and wherever you... pick your poison, like whichever you want to consume.
Well, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Big shout out to Chef Piattoni for coming by. Make sure to check out Meta. We are going to be off next week because David the Engineer says no shows on July 4th weekend. So we will never. But we'll be back in a couple weeks, and we'll be doing a whole new episode of Snacky Tunes. What's the name of the song you're going to take us out with?
I'm going to take us out with Fire.
Perfect. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
The Bulls, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.